questions that causes an occasional one to come in close to the solar system. In fact, there's a comet that you could see tonight if you got a good pair of binoculars that got here through such a disturbance. However, if you're talking about a Kuiper belt that's 100 to 10,000 times bigger than we have here, then this would be a relatively frequent event. And the asteroid that clobbered the planet 65 million years ago, well, you'd be having those kinds of events happening quite frequently, which wouldn't be nice for your investment portfolio. So we now, this confirms just how extraordinary what happened here to planet Earth, namely that we had a disturbance in our solar system when our planet Earth was about 700 million years old. And what was taking place is that we had a Kuiper belt that wasn't 10,000 times bigger, but it was 100 times bigger than what we have right now. And Jupiter and Saturn were interacting with those planetesimals, with those asteroids and comets, and that interaction would cause both of the planets to migrate outward. So Jupiter and Saturn actually started off closer to the Sun than they are right now. But when they're interacting with this primordial Kuiper belt, they moved outward. But that Kuiper belt was a little denser in the region of Saturn than it was of Jupiter, which caused Saturn to move out at a faster rate than Jupiter. Then they reached a point where Saturn was making exactly one orbit for every two orbits of Jupiter. And that's called a 1-2 resonance. And that 1-2 resonance means you're going to get frequent times when Saturn and Jupiter line up, and that's going to gravitationally disturb the entire Kuiper belt. And indeed, that was what was responsible for causing those asteroids and comets to either be scattered out of the solar system or scattered inward towards the Sun. And when they get close to the Sun has breakfast, basically eats them up. Also quite a few of them hit Mars, the Moon, Jupiter, or pardon me, Mars and Venus and Mercury. In fact, if you were to look at the surface of Mercury and our Moon, you'll notice that they're heavily pocked with craters, and you can actually measure the erosion on those craters, and they all date to 3.87 billion years ago. So apparently 3.87 billion years ago, the entire inner solar system was heavily bombarded. And as we look at the bombardment that we see on Mars and Mercury and the Moon, we can calculate what kind of bombardment the Earth took. By the way, the Earth took a heavier bombardment than all the other inner rocky planets combined. We had the biggest damage. At least 18,000 major impactors hit the Earth at that time. And that was actually crucial for making life possible here on planet Earth. Without that bombardment, we wouldn't have the uranium and the thorium and many other elements that are critical for advanced life. That bombardment transformed the core of the Earth. But it also had the effect of reducing the Kuiper belt to about 1% of what it started off with, which means we don't get hit by big, nasty asteroids and comets every couple of weeks. It only happens about every 50 million years, or maybe every 300 or 400 million years. According to Peter Ward's new book, he's claiming that these collision events, at least of the size that wiped out the dinosaurs, are relatively rare, maybe every few hundred million years, not every 25 or 26 million years, like physicists have presumed. The truth may be in between, but I think he's onto something. But this paper that was published in the Astrophysical Journal, again, outlines we live on an exceptionally rare condition. Our solar system, our Sun, our Earth, our Moon, and the planets that accompany our planet Earth, we're not seeing anything like that anywhere else within our galaxy. Matter of fact, if you look at the catalog of 693 planets, where we now have accurate measurements of their mass and their orbital features, not a single one has anything close to the characteristics of any one of the eight planets in our solar system. So it's showing that every planet in our solar system is unique. So it's not just that Earth is unique in its capacity to support advanced life, it's looking like our entire solar system is unique. and unique in its capacity to support life in all of its forms for the period of time that it did. So, you were first, and then I'll take questions going this direction.
Yeah, it seems to me it's a matter of timing when we're looking at things. Suppose somebody's looking at us from outer space somewhere, an advanced civilization, and they see us, and we just happen to we're five billion years old, the solar system. Suppose the sun, enlarges and wipes out, or another planet crashes into us and wipes out. They wouldn't see us, right? Isn't that the same as us looking out?
Well, you're raising a good point, Al. This is kind of where I'm going to go when we segue to our real lesson today. Namely, that if we took all of cosmic history, 13.75 billion years, and compressed that into 24 hours, we humans are on the cosmic scene for just the last 0.3 seconds. And that would be true of any other possibly existing intelligent society anywhere else in the universe. And therefore, this is not good news if you're trying to search for extraterrestrial intelligent life, because unless you're looking in that narrow window of time, they're not going to be there. But I would also argue they're not going to be there because we can't even find a star that has the necessary characteristics to support advanced life. As I said here before in the class, a lot of my friends are committed to the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life, but I'm encouraging them to abandon the search and do something more fruitful, because after all, we can't even find a single star that would be a candidate, so why bother looking for signals from planets around those stars if indeed the star isn't just right? But you're also running up against this. Unless that civilization's in that narrow time window, they're not going to have the technology to beam any signals towards us. So, kind of where I'm going to go in the lesson is trying to explain why it is that there is such exceptionally narrow time window, and why we would be forced to conclude that without God's intervention, we wouldn't be here. It's really quite extraordinary how many different time windows must line up, and there's nothing in the physics that says the time windows all have to coincide. If you get a time window over here and a time window over here, then you eliminate the possibility for advanced life. The time windows have to line up. Okay, I'm moving.
We have a first-time hand raiser, and we're going to go first.
All right.
First,
go ahead.
First pick.
All right.
I was just wondering, do you think that maybe the uniqueness of our solar system is due to the size of our sun compared to other universes?
Okay, what about the size of our sun? Astronomers refer to our sun as ordinary, and that's really a misnomer. It is true that our sun has kind of a median mass. There's lots of stars that are less massive than the sun, lots of stars that are more massive than the sun, and ours is kind of in between. But that doesn't mean our sun is ordinary. But I'll be sharing with you briefly just how uniquely designed our sun is to make possible the existence of advanced life. And for 50 years, a team of astronomers in the United States and Brazil have been searching for a solar twin. And in 50 years of searching, they've yet to find a solar twin. They're finding solar analogs. But let me tell you how astronomers define a solar analog. That's any star that's within 80% and 120% of the mass of the sun. That's roughly the age of the sun, between 3 and 6 billion years old. Well, we're finding thousands of these solar analogs. However, as you're going to soon see, unless the star is almost exactly the age of our star, the sun, it's not a candidate. It has to be exactly the mass of our star, the sun, and it needs to have certain constituents in terms of its chemistry and its atmosphere and interior to be a candidate. And we've yet to find a star of the right mass, of the right age, that's got the right chemistry to be a candidate for advanced life. So, as I said, 50 years of searching, they can't find one. But what's also interesting is they found plenty of stars that are twins of one another. So all the stars we see in our Milky Way galaxy, almost all of them have got twins. The one that doesn't have a twin is our star, the sun. So it's special. It doesn't have a family, no twins. Yes?
I was going to say, just like DNA sampling is getting better over time, over the last 50 years, has the science in researching this become better, or has really the science been?
Oh, the science has gotten a lot better. And so, 30 years ago, all we could do was determine whether a star was an analog of the sun as opposed to a twin.
But they've gone back and re-looked at it and said, no, that's not it.
Right. Okay. Lots of times astronomers have announced they found a twin of the sun, and then they had to say, no,
then
we didn't.
They go back with better research.
They said what we found was a semi-twin,
yeah.
Not an exact twin. So there are no exact twins. But what is interesting, we have found lots of stars that are exact twins of one another. It's a sun that doesn't have a twin. And, I've always argued to my SETI friends, those who are searching for extraterrestrial intelligent life, if you don't have a star that's an exact twin, you don't have a candidate to look at. But they're looking anyway. And that's like, why look? We already know. You're not going to find anything. Yes?
Origin of life. You've said on many occasions that it would take, even if it were possible from naturalistic processes, that it would take billions of years, which didn't happen. Naturalistic processes are certainly part of our marvelous creation just as much as miraculous processes are. So they're both God's territory. But I see arguments on both sides that, oh yes, there's a perfectly logical naturalistic explanation for the progression from inorganic to organic matter in life, and arguments on the other side that it's absolutely there's no evidence at all. And how do you draw a straight line through this?
How you draw a straight line through this? You go over to the table and get Buzz Rana's latest book, Life in the Lab, because what Buzz has done in that book is just showing you the amazing progress chemists have made in the laboratory at reconstructing some of the pathways that we know are critical for the origin of life. But his point is, it's done with well-funded, intelligent beings equipped with a lot of technology under controlled laboratory conditions, and they're able to duplicate a few of the critical steps. They're not yet making life from scratch, but they're able to take pieces from existing life forms and actually develop the chemistry to make it all happen. And Buzz's whole argument is, look at the intelligence and the funding and the knowledge of these chemists that are pulling off these amazing advances and trying to duplicate some of the chemical pathways that we know are critical for the origin of life. Surely somebody better funded with more technology and greater intellect must be responsible for the actual origin of life. And so in terms of trying to solve the origin of life problem, what's critical in trying to dialogue with people who come from a non-theistic perspective is say, laboratory is one thing. What about real conditions that we know existed at the time of the origin of life on planet Earth? And so in that sense, all these amazing achievements that have been taking place in the laboratory are irrelevant to the origin of life on planet Earth, because we know the conditions that we're using in the laboratory are not what we see here on the Earth. By the way, when I've been debating biologists on whether or not God's responsible for life, they typically want to pass on the origin of life. They know they're in trouble on the origin of life. And say, we want to talk about what happens after the origin of life. What I like to do is point out, no, wait a minute, the origin of life is the easiest problem for the evolutionists to reconcile. Because now we're talking about taking amino acids and sugars and nucleotides and trying to pull them together into a very simple living organism. You really can't get any simpler than that. That's the simplest step in terms of the whole question of the evolution of life here on planet Earth from a naturalistic perspective. In fact, sometimes I go one step further and say the simplest step in the origin of life is simply getting all the amino acids lined up. Because we know the amino acids all have to be left-handed, except for the one that doesn't have any chirality, and all the sugars have to be right-handed. What could be a simpler problem for the origin of life community than to come up with an explanation under realistic conditions where you get all the sugars right-handed and all the amino acids left-handed? There's no answer to that problem. In fact, I'm writing an article this afternoon on the best attempt to try to solve that problem, which is circularly ultraviolet polarized light coming out of neutron stars and black holes. And they just announced in the Astrophysical Journal that they were able to achieve a chirality movement of 1.34%. What that means is instead of having 50% left and 50% right, they were able to get about 51% left and 49% right. But in order for origin of life to take place, it's got to be 100%. Because if all the amino acids aren't 100% oriented the same way, you can't link them together. You know, it's kind of like taking Legos and pushing them together. And if you turn it around, they don't go together. They have to go together according to a particular sequence. And so it's critical that they all be, sugars be right-handed, the amino acids be left-handed. So even that simplest step has no solution anywhere on planet Earth or anywhere in the universe. Now, they have been able to make it work in the lab. They can do it in the lab, and that's often what happens. People say, well, we've solved the chirality problem. Yeah, in the lab, but not under realistic conditions that exist in the realm of nature. And by the way, I can't think of a worse place for the origin of life than next to a neutron star or a black hole. And by the way, what the mechanism there is that the circularly polarized ultraviolet light destroys one hand more efficiently than the other hand. But notice it's destroying the molecules. That's not a good thing if you're trying to build up a rich mixture of amino acids. And by the way, under naturalistic conditions, we're not seeing anything better than about 15 parts per million of amino acids. And that's way too diluted a concentration to be of any benefit for the origin of life. So it's those kinds of arguments. Very simple chemistry and physics, which shows the intractability of the origin of life question from a naturalistic perspective. But what you have to do is convince the atheist biologist that's your easiest problem to solve. Everything else is orders of magnitude more difficult. You're next.
I guess two or three related questions. How common is it for planets to migrate in and migrate out? And if they're migrating in, don't they sort of wipe out all the other planets in front of them? And how stable are the orbits over over billions of years? If they migrate around, wouldn't they just tend to migrate all the way into the star or migrate all the way out of the solar system?
Well, for the migration to take place, there's got to be planetesimals in the environment. So once the planetesimals are dissipated, the migration stops. However, what this particular paper is pointing out is we're finding sun-like stars that are 3 to 6 billion years old that still have very heavy belts of these planetesimals, which means the migration would continue. Now, the planetesimals are far enough away and the inner part of the solar system is depleted, that would stop the migration of planets that are relatively close. And indeed, as we're discovering planets outside of our solar system, the vast majority are orbiting close to their planets. But that's the region where we expect depletion of the planetesimals to be the most efficient. And so that would explain why we're not finding a lot of distant planets. Evidently, they're either coming crashing into their stars or they're being migrated so far out where we're not going to have any possibility of detecting them. So, but you also raise another point. If you've got lots of planets migrating around, that's certainly going to disturb the orbits of any planets that could potentially support life. And so one of the special blessings of our solar system is that the migration was relatively minor in the first place, and it stopped fairly quickly. And in terms of the inner solar system, there was no significant migration because the planetesimals got dissipated quite quickly. They hung around for Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and actually it was a good thing because it pulled those planets farther away. And if that didn't happen, then the gravity of Jupiter would be so powerfully interacting with the Earth, it would be disturbing the orbit of our planet Earth. It's barely far enough away to prevent that from happening. So if it wasn't for the migration of Jupiter, we'd be in trouble. But thank God there wasn't a whole lot of migration, because if it had migrated farther away yet, then Jupiter would not provide an adequate gravitational shield to stop us getting hit more frequently than we are from asteroids and comets. already, just in the past 10 years, we've seen Jupiter get clobbered twice by big comets. And thank God it took the hit and not us. Now, let's see, you're next, and I'll come back to you, John.
You defined the solar analog as plus or minus 20% of the solar mass, but what is the definition of an exact solar twin, and how accurately can you measure the mass of a solar twin?
Okay, the definition of an exact solar twin would be a star that would have all the conditions that would make possible the existence of advanced life. And what they mean by advanced life would be the equivalent of mammals and birds. So, and that requires very carefully fine-tuned conditions. So, your second question, I think, is a good one, too. How many stars out there where we can make measurements to the sufficient degree of precision to tell whether or not they're a twin? You're probably looking maybe at a million. So it's not a large number. But that number gets larger with advancing technology. And in terms of really accurate measurements, it's probably in the neighborhood of 10,000 stars we can look at with sufficient precision. And the most challenging part of all is determining the mass of the star. That's difficult. You know, we got another star or planet orbiting it, then we can determine its mass with high precision. And, you know, with all the discovery of all these planets, that's going to help. Because that will also help us pin down the mass of the star, not just the mass of the planet that's orbiting it. So that data is coming in. And, you know, I would say in the last 2 years, we've been much better positioned than we were in the past 50 years for finding these exact twins. And it is such that there is a great anticipation that we would find these twins. So far, we haven't found any. So you're next, and over here again. Yes.
As you're well aware, young Earth creationists like to use the depth of the dust on the moon as an argument for their position. And I know there is a counterpoint to their position with new research and new findings. I just don't remember what it is, so could you elaborate?
Sure. I mean, you're right. Young Earth creationists will claim that there's way too little dust on the surface of the moon for the moon to be billions of years old. Therefore, we're looking at a universe that's only thousands of years old, not billions like all these astronomers are claiming that it really is. The rebuttal to that is that the assumption that we would have hundreds of feet of dust, and some of you are older in this class, may remember a time when there was some hesitation about sending men to the moon because the spaceship might drown in several hundred feet of dust. And that was in the early 1960s. And so there was quite a bit of a response from the voters saying, should we really fund this thing that Kennedy wants us to fund when we could simply wind up losing the craft and losing the astronauts? That doesn't sound like a good thing. Well, as you notice, that taxpayer objection was quickly overcome. And here's the story. Back in 1960, and try to remember the geophysicist's name, but it's in my books. But he did an experiment on top of Mauna Kea Mountain in Hawaii. And what he did is he put a filter 4 feet above the ground and was measuring the amount of dust passing through the filter. And he was presuming that all the dust passing through the filter would be cosmic dust. And so he wound up publishing a paper where he said, if all the dust coming through my filter is cosmic dust, then over the course of 4.5 billion years, there would be several hundred feet of dust on the surface of the moon. But he closed his paper off by saying, please remember, my filter is only 4 feet off the top of Mauna Kea Mountain. It's probable that most of the dust going through the filter is not cosmic dust, but is recirculated terrestrial dust. And therefore, he argued in this paper that his experiment needed to be repeated with high-altitude balloon experiments and, better yet, satellites. So he was trying to encourage NASA to set up a satellite to measure the dust. Well, that was done. And thanks partly to the voter resistance saying, we're not sure we want to back this a space program if there's all that dust out there. Well, it's relatively cheap to send up a spaceship to measure dust. And quite cheap, too, to send up a high-altitude balloon. The balloon experiments were done first. They went up as high as 100,000 to 120,000 feet above the ground. and basically reported that, yeah, it was Hans Pedersen, I think the guy's name was, that his estimates of dust coming through his filter were off by a factor of 1,100 times. In other words, less than a tenth of a percent of the dust coming through his filter was actually cosmic dust. And therefore, this caused NASA to do detailed models on the sun, and they basically determined that dust does accumulate, but every once in a while a big meteor hits the moon, which causes a lot of dust to leave. And then you've got ultraviolet radiation that would break down the rocks and produce the dust. So you've got three mechanisms that would add dust to the moon or remove dust from the moon. And when they were all done, they determined that over 4.5 billion years, you're going to get 60 millimeters of dust average on the surface of the moon, which encouraged NASA to say, well, you know, 300 feet would be a problem. A little more than a couple of inches, that shouldn't be a big deal. And when Apollo 11 landed on the moon back in 1969, guess what they found on the surface of the moon? 60 millimeters of dust. Exactly what the best models had predicted is what they found. And so the dust on the moon actually proves that the moon is 4.5 billion years old. If it was as young as the younger creations had calculated, it should be something on the order of a couple of microns thick, not 60 millimeters of dust. Well, I see Dave at the back, which means the signal we got to get started with this lesson. So, but I'll take your question quickly, and then we'll move to the lesson. Yes. Well, if Jupiter did not migrate and it wound up being closer to the sun than it actually is, its gravity exerted on the Earth would actually disturb the movement of the Earth around the sun. And that disturbance may not eliminate the possibility of bacteria existing on the planet, but it would certainly eliminate the possibility that we would exist on the planet. So, yeah, next month when you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for the fact that Jupiter migrated sufficiently far away that you're able to enjoy your Thanksgiving dinner, but not too far away, because likewise then you would not be able to enjoy your Thanksgiving dinner. Okay, let's segue to this. Why is it that we can only exist in a very narrow window of time? And this is something I mentioned last week, has got the title, The Anthropic Principle Inequality. Namely, that if you look at the laws of physics, gravity, electromagnetism, and the strong and weak nuclear force, and thermodynamics, astronomers calculate that it's impossible to bring human beings upon the cosmic scene in anything less than about 14 billion years. And by the way, this applies to the entire universe. Or as some of my friends in the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life have admitted, we have to be the first intelligent beings on the scene because it's impossible for physics to bring intelligent life any earlier, which means don't bother looking far away, because if you're looking far away, it takes time for that light signal to get to you, which means that you're looking earlier than the time in which intelligent life could possibly appear. But Brannon Carter, who discovered that it takes a minimum of this 14 billion years, also noted that the same laws of physics demand that intelligent life can only exist in a civilized state for no longer than 41,000 years. And our own calculations and reasons to believe indicate that it's probably closer to 20,000 years than 41,000 years. But as Carter pointed out, there's a factor of a million difference between the minimum time to prepare a home and the maximum time in which we can live in a civilized state. And as I mentioned last week, I'm not saying this is the maximum time that humans can exist on the face of the Earth. It's the maximum time we can exist in a civilized state. If you're okay with 10,000 people living on the planet with Stone Age technology, then you can extend that 41,000 years to maybe 100 or 200,000 years. But if you're talking where you've got towns and trade going on and a relatively large population, then you're stuck with that 41,000-year maximum, or in our case, we believe it's a 20,000-year maximum. And have you worried how much longer we've got left? We've had that level of civilization for the past 11,000 years. So if you like our numbers, we got 9,000 years to go. If you like Brandon Carter's numbers, well, you've got, 22,000 or 32,000 years to go. Either case is not a lot of time. Now, you'll find this described in some detail in my book over there, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. But here are some of the reasons, and I think we've discussed this already, namely that uranium and thorium are critical for advanced life. Without uranium and thorium, you will not have the heat source that's necessary to set up a strong, stable magnetic field and also to transform our planet Earth from a water world into a world where you've got oceans and continents. It's uranium and thorium that provide the energy source for establishing that magnetic field and for forming the continents. And uranium and thorium are produced only in supergiant stars. Supernova are the only source of uranium and thorium in the universe. And when the universe is young, it's aggressively producing these supernova events. And therefore, you're going to see a quantity of uranium and thorium in the universe accumulate until that time when star formation begins to decline. And today, star formation has shut down on about 90% of all the galaxies. And because uranium and thorium are radiometric, they decay with respect to time, so it reaches a time when the abundance of uranium and thorium goes down. But what you notice there is that there's a point where uranium and thorium hit a peak abundance. It occurs when the universe is slightly more than 9 billion years old, but that's identical to the time that the Earth formed in the history of the universe. So in terms of trying to find a place for advanced life, it's only going to exist on a planet that's slightly more than 4.5 billion years old. What's the age of our planet? 4.5662 billion years. Our Earth formed at the very peak. Now, you can say, well, why didn't God put us here 4.5 billion years ago? Well, as I mentioned last week, we've actually found in Africa natural nuclear reactors. Now, these are nuclear reactors that are no longer running. And the problem with uranium is that it actually has several isotopes that are radioactive. The most common one on the planet today, uranium-238, decays with a half-life of 4.5 billion years. But uranium-235 has a half-life of 705 million years. So when the Earth was young, it had a lot of uranium-235. Now, uranium-235 is what you make atomic bombs out of. Uranium-238 is useless for making nuclear weapons. It's only the uranium-235 that will set up a chain reaction. And this place in Okla, Gabon, 2 billion years ago, had a natural chain reaction running. And it's because it had a fairly dense ore deposit of uranium next to water. And what the water does is it provides a medium whereby you can get the neutrons in sufficient concentration that it sets up a chain reaction. So you get a chain reaction going, but that chain reaction liberates heat, evaporates the water, the chain reaction stops. And when the chain reaction stops, the water goes from a vapor state to a liquid state, so the chain reaction starts up again. So in this place in Africa, 2 billion years ago, 3 billion years ago, there was these cycles of nuclear fission going on. Now, fortunately, there's been so much decay of uranium-235 that that natural chain reaction no longer runs. There simply isn't enough uranium-235 left. So that explains why, for example, you're going to want to have human beings existing well after these natural chain reactions take place. I mean, you don't want to be around a natural chain reaction. That's why when we build a nuclear reactor, we put a big concrete shield around it, because you don't want that radiation getting out to the human population. Well, again, 2-3 billion years ago, that was happening over the face of the Earth. Keep in mind, uranium even today is more abundant than tin and antimony in the crust of the Earth. It's one of the more abundant elements, and it's even more abundant in the interior of the Earth. So that explains why you want humans quite a bit later. Now, you don't want us a whole lot longer, because if we're a whole lot longer, then there's so much decay of uranium and thorium that it's not going to be sufficient to sustain this strong, stable magnetic field. Say, why do you need that? Well, something else you can thank God for when you celebrate Thanksgiving is you live on a planet where you've got a magnetic field of a strength of about 1 gauss that varies between 0.5 gauss and about 1¾ gauss over the last few billion years. And that strong, stable magnetic field stops our atmosphere from being sputtered away by particles coming out of the sun. And so we get to keep our atmosphere with all of its chemical constituents. And also that the magnetic field acts as a shield in that it sets up Van Allen belts, and those Van Allen belts surrounding the Earth protect us from getting clobbered by cosmic radiation and short wavelength solar radiation. A couple other things you can thank God for come Thanksgiving. But if you wait too long, then you won't have enough energy from the uranium and thorium to maintain that magnetic field or to maintain the growth of the continents. And if you don't maintain the growth of the continents, erosion will erode them away. And so parts of the United States, the states are getting smaller due to erosion. We live in one of the few places where our state is actually getting bigger. So California gets bigger every year. But the one that really grows fast is Hawaii and Alaska. Lots of tectonic activity is causing those states to get bigger and bigger. So you want to maintain that. That in itself explains why you've got a relatively narrow window of time. Let's say relatively narrow. Uranium and thorium abundance would allow a time window that would be tens of millions of years wide. So this is not one that says it's got to be very small, but it does give you some idea why we've got to be here now and not sometime later. Now, one that I think is much more restrictive is what's happening on the sun. And this is the latest update. I've written 4 articles on this that's up on our reasons.org website. But due to some measurements of solar analogs, we're now able to determine the luminosity history of the sun. And what we notice is that stars like the sun lose about 20% of their mass. 10 to 20% of their mass, and the luminosity of a star goes up with a 1/4 power of its mass. So this is what happens in the history of the sun. It accumulates mass and gets brighter when it's extremely young, and it reaches a point where it stops accumulating mass and then begins to lose mass, and it precipitately drops in its luminosity. So there was a time when our sun was twice as bright as it is now, during the time when it was accumulating mass. And then it quickly dimmed as a result of mass loss. Then there reached a point when the sun was about 1 billion to 1.5 billion years old when it stopped losing mass. By the way, it's still losing mass, but it's losing a very tiny amount of mass per year. So little that it really doesn't make any difference in the luminosity of the sun. But you say, well, what then causes the sun to brighten? Well, as the sun continues to convert hydrogen into helium in its core, or to put it another way, our star is like a gigantic hydrogen bomb. What gives the energy of the hydrogen bomb? It's hydrogen being fused into helium. And 4 hydrogen atoms weigh a little bit more than 1 helium atom. And that loss of mass gets converted into pure energy, and that's basically what gives all the heat and sun, or heat and light out of the sun. However, as that fusion of hydrogen to helium takes place over hundreds of millions and billions of years, it increases the density of the core of the sun, because helium is denser than hydrogen. And that increasing density causes the nuclear fusion reaction in the sun to run more efficiently. And so as the sun gets older and older and continues to burn hydrogen into helium, the efficiency of the solar furnace gets greater and greater, which causes the sun to get brighter and brighter with respect to time. And that little blue line you got there, that's the current age of our solar system. And there is a particular luminosity that's ideal for human beings. If you're a bacterium, you can handle the sun when it's about this bright. But as you only at this point can you have human beings and mammals and birds. And you can say, well, what about back here? And what about back here? Well, back here and here, the luminosity of the sun was changing at such a dramatic rate that it would not be conducive to advanced life. You have to have a particular luminosity of the star where the luminosity is not changing too quickly with respect to time. And there's only a narrow window of time when you get the just right brightness out of the sun. And so that explains, that's one of the reasons why humans must exist where they are. Hey, I see that I'm out of time. Well, let me close with this, because I think this will be exciting for Thanksgiving as well. And this came up before the class got started, 10 minutes before the class got started. Several of you were asking me about the geometry of the universe and about, you know, just how fast is the universe expanding. Well, if the universe, say God put us here, instead of 14 billion years after the cosmic creation event, only about 10 billion years after the cosmic creation event. The way the physics of the universe works, all the matter and energy is constrained to the surface of the universe. A good analogy is planet Earth. Planet Earth is a three-dimensional body, but all the life on planet Earth is restricted to the surface or very near the surface of the Earth. So, for example, if I want to go to Paris, I can't go there with a straight line path. I'm constrained to travel on the curved surface of the Earth. So it takes me longer to get to Paris than if I were able to go straight through the Earth. Well, the same thing happens with the universe. All the matter and energy, in fact, even the space-time dimensionality, is constrained to the surface of the universe. And it takes time for light from the cosmic creation event, the moment when the universe was created, to travel along the space surface and reach our telescope. So if we were put here any earlier, insufficient time would have gone by for that light to travel on the space surface and get to our telescope. What does that mean? If God put us here a little bit earlier than what he did, we astronomers would not be able to see the radiation from the cosmic creation event. And we'd be lacking some of the most compelling scientific proofs for the existence of God and the personal attributes that God manifests. You know, it tells us in the book of Romans, we're all without excuse because we've all seen God revealed through the heavens. Well, that revelation isn't completely there except for a moment of time. You say, well, couldn't God wait a little bit later? Well, that's where our discussion was coming, because people were worried that with dark energy, and that means in the relatively near future, the universe's surface will be expanding faster than the velocity of light. And that's exactly right. As we astronomers look at the farthest reaches along the surface of the universe, those farthest reaches are traveling at barely under the velocity of light, which means in the relatively near future, those farthest reaches will be moving at faster than the velocity of light, which means light from the cosmic creation event will never reach our telescopes. What does that mean? We live in the one narrow window of time when we astronomers get to see the entire history of the universe from the beginning right up to the present moment. We can read the picture book of the universe, but you can only read that picture book at one time in the universe. And what we're going to be seeing, I'm not sure if I'm going to be here next week or not. No, I think I'm going to be in Seattle this next Sunday. So I'll catch you when I'm back, whenever that is. You'll see it on the calendar. By the way, go to reasons.org or go to paradoxes.org. It'll give us the speaking schedule for this class. But the whole point is these narrow time windows in which he can possibly exist are coincident with a narrow time window when we get to do the important science that tells us about the universe and what God did in the universe to prepare for our human beings. So you've actually got two independent arguments for the anthropic principle and equality. I'm sorry for the extra time, but let's bow and pray, and I'll see you whenever I get back. Father in heaven, thank you for allowing us to live in this 21st century window when we are actually able to explore the universe and the life here on planet Earth to the depth that we can. Father, I pray that you would grant us the humility to recognize what you revealed about yourself, about the universe, but most importantly, about us human beings and our need for you in terms of personal salvation. So, Lord, I pray that you'd help us to emulate Job, look at what you've created, and recognize what you've done on our behalf. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
this volunteer meeting will be on this side of the classroom in a little while.
Okay, so at the surface of the universe, there's a pulsar in the path that wouldn't be easier to see.